ProFlowers.com presents President Bill Clinton. Hey, America. Number 42 here for ProFlowers.com, the number one internet site for flowers. Now, I've ordered my share of flowers in my day. The ladies do like the flowers. But this fine bouquet from the I'm Sorry series is one they designed especially for me, President Bill. And let me tell you something, America. These flowers look good. Heck, if I had a nickel for every time I've had to buy one of these for Hillary, well, I could open a flower shop. But this series is special. This time, I'm giving this series of flowers to you, America. From a certain lady that wants to say, I'm sorry. Order these flowers today and type in the discount code Hillary. And when you order them, you'll not only get a 10% discount, but you will know how truly sorry Hillary is.
On the campaign trail, presidential candidate Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton told voters in New Hampshire she would not describe her vote in support of the invasion of Iraq as a mistake. Clinton said, quote, "If the most important thing to any of you is choosing someone who did not cast that vote or has said his vote was a mistake, then there are others to choose from," she said.
Oh, damn it, Hillary! ProFlowers.com. We'll say I'm sorry for you. So, just say you're sorry already. Jeez! Hey everybody, it's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. This week on Indirect Democracy, we have part 2 of signing statements, plus we have the global warming update, 2 new sponsors, the President's Horoscope, and the What a Weenie Award. And welcome! Welcome to podcast number 24 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. I am your host. My name is David. I want to thank you for joining for part 2 of the signing statements. If you have any questions or comments and want to get a hold of me, you can do so via my email at david@indirectdemocracy.com or through the listener call-in line, which is area code 206-339-4797. And as always, Indirect Democracy is a very proud member of the Progressive Podcast Network. Glad to be associated with them. You can find their website at www.progressivepodcastnetwork.org. You can also find their blog site at newmediarevolutionaries.com. Let's see. I know there's more. Let's see. If you would like to also find more information on Indirect Democracy, you can go to the MySpace page, which is myspace.com/indirectdemocracy. Or, if you like, on the homepage for Indirect Democracy, if you'd like to just click the little link and indicate where you are, you can do so via the Frapper map, which is found at the bottom of the homepage for Indirect Democracy. A quick update on getting the website to work. I've been able to make certain updates. It's like using other computers. Still not have found a way to get my account to come up on my computer. I'm working on it, but I apologize. Some updates have not taken place in the way I'd like them to. But I will be making updates accordingly, and I thank you for your patience on that matter. Going to do things a little bit differently here. As you could tell, we had an ad at the beginning of the show. We'll have a different sponsor later on. But I also want to let you know that this week's global warming update has been moved towards the end of the show because it's going to be in conjunction with the What a Weenie Award. I had a What a Weenie Award already thought out of my head and realized that there were events that occurred this week that caused that sort of to be bumped aside, but I did not want to lose the importance of this particular news piece. So, this is not the What a Weenie Award for this particular episode of Indirect Democracy, but this I'm going to call the Cocktail Weenie Award, and here it is. Now, this sort of Cocktail Weenie Award is going to go to Vice President Richard Cheney, and I gave him this despite my internal belief that I should have probably given this to Hillary Clinton for the whole David Geffen thing, or to that whacked-out judge that oversaw the whole thing about the dead porn star. but I had to go back to the one statement that to me was crazier than the rest. Now, this past month, Great Britain announced the withdrawal of their troops from Iraq. Now, my own beliefs are that this is not due to any big mission accomplished banner or because Prince Harry's going there. I think that the Brits are smart enough to try and not be there when the United States decides to attack Iran, and Britain pretty much wants no part of that at all. Now, this move would be considered as nothing more than a blow to our national policy and how our country's surge would be viewed worldwide. In essence, we have just been left behind by our biggest ally as they begin their withdrawal of troops. Now, of course, 7,500 troops pales to our 150,000, but the second largest contribution, if you don't consider private contractors, is about to withdraw. In any way that anybody would see it, this would be a blow to this administration. But Vice President Cheney had this to say.
I look at it, and what I see is an affirmation of the fact that there are parts of Iraq where things are going pretty well. In fact, I talked to a friend just the other day who had driven from Baghdad down to Basra in 7 hours, found the situation dramatically improved compared to where it was a year or so ago. Sort of validated the British view that they have made progress in southern Iraq and that they can therefore afford to reduce their force levels.
Now, leave it to Vice President Cheney to act as if this was a sure sign of victory. In fact, to prepare for this victory party, Cheney went to Australia to invite 20,000 Australians to the big going-away party in Iraq. But, sadly, or maybe with great insight, the Australians told us that they had a thing and couldn't make it. At times, I often wonder about where such myopia comes from on the part of the Vice President. I mean, honestly, how do you come up with that? I like to believe that he has a magic little eight ball of available attitudes, or that somewhere he has a chip in his body he can effectively program to turn off the old sanity on occasion. You know, every now and then he thinks,
only 18% of the country approves of what I'm doing. That's 82% of the country that I should invite hunting.
I mean, the one thing that I'm happy about is that the conservatives are not using this to denigrate or insult the United Kingdom. The United States has a great ally in the people of Great Britain. They are a strong and proud nation, a nation we should look to as a friend. And what they are doing is the sign of a good friend. Basically, they're your pal Nick. You know Nick. Nick's your pal. Nick's your buddy. Nick won't mind if you puke in his car. But Nick has seen us in a bad place right now. Maybe we're too drunk with power or the wrong party in an abusive relationship. But Nick has stood by our side. He's just decided that he's no longer going to be dragged down with us. Oh, he'll be there to pick us up afterwards. Maybe even bail us out of jail. But he's not going to get into another accident with us. And therein lies the rub. The UK is our friend. And the Vice President is too dumb, or maybe too deep in self-denial, to realize our friend has given us a clear message. It's done. It's over. There's nothing left to do but fix up the umpteenth bar you decided to trash. But leave it to Cheney and company to act like they can still get that phone number, or win that bar fight, and the only thing that kept them from winning was that their belt was probably just a little too tight, and they weren't feeling loose enough out there. Either way, our friends have given us a message. Don't disregard it. Because in not listening to their advice and acting as if it does not matter, Mr. Cheney, you again prove why you are a big, or maybe at least this time, a cocktail weenie. Oh, and for you movie buffs, that was my homage to The Sure Thing. Now, usually about this time, I give out the president's horoscope. Earlier this week, I did part one of signing statements, and I gave out the president's career horoscope for this past week. Well, there are always two parts of those horoscopes. One part is the career horoscope, and one part is the love horoscope. Since I have already read the career horoscope for this past week, I thought that this week, from the pages of Elle magazine, I would read the love horoscope. And because our president is a Cancer, here is his love horoscope for this past week. For the week of February 25th, 2007, the president's love meter reading is a 7. Hold on. Gotta do the voice. I have to do somewhat more of a sexy voice. for February 26th through March 4th. Everything will be smoother and easier for you. Hold on. I need some good music to go with this. Oh yeah. There's the love horoscope music I was looking for. Oh yeah. For February 26th through March 4th. Everything will be smoother and easier for you if you're willing to compromise a bit more. If you're exhausted by the status quo or the siege you've coped with during the past couple of years. Oh my god! That's funny. Opt for change. I know you don't want to do that usually, President Bush, but opt for change. Oh yeah, this music. Make it easy for others to make peace with you by giving them little to argue with. It's no longer about winning, Cancer. Are you listening, President Bush? It's about the quality of life you want and need. Oh yeah. Current circumstances are taking an emotional and physical toll. It's time for a real change. Not just semantics, or maybe someday promises. You owe this to yourself and your loved ones. This week's touchstones are chalcedony and bloodstone. And that is President Bush's love horoscope for the week of February 26th through March 4th. Oh man, I think I'm going to switch over to the love horoscope from now on. That was more fun. If you like that one, write me at david@indirectdemocracy.com if you would like me to use the love horoscope or the career meter reading horoscope, because I had a lot more fun reading that one. And also, that one seemed to be a lot more on target than any of the past presidential horoscopes. Oh my goodness. I've now veered off into, you're never going to take me seriously for the rest of this podcast land. But let's try to get back on track. Here is an ad from the Progressive Podcast Network.
Hello, this is America's 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, a.k.a. Honest Abe, a.k.a. the Rail Splitter, a.k.a. President Feelgood, a.k.a. the Great Emancipator. Please, don't get up. I'm just a regular guy like you, only I'm like 20 feet tall, and my hands are so lean and work callous that they can serve as bladed weapons. My beard is really scratchy, which is not to say that I am unapproachable. A lot of people say to me, President Lincoln, aren't you dead? Well, I fix them with my trademark steely one-room log cabin glare and say, we're all dead if we don't start paying attention to how this country is run. And some guys will say, is that a threat? To those jokers, I really lay it on. The mole on my face sticks out about a quarter of an inch, so I turn my head a few degrees until it's pointing right at them. Freaks their game out. It's accusing. I say to them, that's not a threat, that's a promise. A promise to diligently scour the news and report items of note with a smooth, double malt Kentucky charisma. So if you're keen to hear a party independent voice that doesn't ignore the alternative news and takes the time to both analyze and lampoon the paid disinformation and propaganda of corporate news, visit theabrahamlincolnlogs.com. Listen via the browser or subscribe with your podcatcher of choice. Come on down. We're not hard to find. Keep going until you pass the Daily Cause, and when you get to the Huffington Post, turn left. This is Honest Abe Lincoln, and I'm proud to be a member of the Progressive Podcast Network.
In the last podcast, I discussed what signing statements are and how they were used by past presidents and abused by this president. In this part, I want to discuss the legal dangers and validity of signing statements. But before I do, let's take a step back real quick and look at the roles of each branch of government. The legislative, as described in the first article of the Constitution, passes and creates the laws. They also hold the purse strings for the law and, in general, have the power of oversight over those matters which are granted to them in Article 1, which, if you read that part of the Constitution, is really quite expansive. Congress and its role were considered so important it was the first body mentioned in the Constitution, Article 1. That's not a coincidence. Nor is the fact that the makeup of representation was so important to the founders and to this new nation that had the function of the House and Senate and its representation not been created, there would be no United States under this Constitution. The President, as described in the second article, acts to execute the laws of the land, with the knowledge that his ability to establish his cabinet and chief members of his staff can only come with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, this is not to say that he is at the whim of the Congress. You know, that is not the defined role. But his job is as defined by the role of Congress as is his by what Congress cannot do. They cannot create treaties with foreign countries, but they can choose to not ratify such treaties. They cannot command the troops, but they can raise monies for and support our armed forces. They have the power to declare war and authorize the use of force, and even call forth the militias to suppress insurrections and repel invasions. They cannot pass into law every bill. The President can veto them. So, when you consider the many defined roles of our Congress and the Constitution, it comes as no surprise why the executive strives for greater control. Yet the importance of co-equal and separate powers is no small thing. James Madison described this as essential to the preservation of liberty. Our president's role is to faithfully execute the law. By that definition alone, he is not a lawmaker. Congress creates the law. The president executes them. The Supreme Court ensures that they're constitutional. I mean, it sounds simple, doesn't it? So, why are there signing statements, and what makes them dangerous? Now, the first part of that would be the line item veto. As discussed, the President has one role when it comes to the passing of a bill into law, to either approve it or veto it. Signing statements take on a type of role that is similar in nature to the line item veto. The line item veto is a type of veto that the court has ruled unconstitutional. A line item veto is a tool used by the executive or governors of many states. It allows them to strike out portions of a bill. The bright side is that it allows a governor, as an example, to strike out last-minute spending packages or rules that he or she may disfavor. Unfortunately, the president is not granted that type of veto. When a bill comes his way, he has to accept it all or veto the whole thing. The courts have ruled that there can be no line item veto for the president. So, here's what a signing statement does. The president can effectively refuse to enact portions of a law he is constitutionally required to execute. He can pick and choose those laws. In essence, using a de facto form of line item veto, which is considered unconstitutional. The next danger is, and this is a commonly used argument, is that signing statements supposedly have no real power. A commonly used argument that signing statements have no real power or effect is that, supposedly, they're not cited by the courts. Well, that argument is easily refuted on two points. The first is that the purpose of brokering the deal with West Publishing was to give the signing statements validity on a level with the courts and Congress. That's one. Second, according to the Nussbaum memo mentioned in the last podcast, the memo to President Clinton, in the case of Federal Election Commission versus the NRA Political Victory Fund, the court cited to and relied upon a presidential signing statement that had declared that a congressionally enacted limitation on the president's constitutional authority to appoint an office of the United States was without legal force or effect. As well, signing statements were cited in U.S. versus Story and in Hamden versus Rumsfeld, the case regarding the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005. Now, the next part of that argument is that signing statements lack any power since they have no real effect, and that no one will implement them, especially the president. Again, this argument fails. In 1830, the Congress passed a bill that called for monies to be spent for a road that was supposed to go from Detroit to Chicago. President Jackson issued a signing statement that the roads were not to extend beyond Michigan. Despite objections from the House, in the end, they acquiesced to Jackson's signing statement. As well, people will argue that the president will not do anything to break the law or fail to faithfully execute the laws. But that says nothing about his staff. A signing statement, in essence, is a presidential directive, not unlike a policy statement. To believe that the president's staff or underlings within the executive branch will not follow a presidential directive is to believe that his staff will be insubordinate. The president may not break the law, but an underling will. The truth about signing statements is that they're not going to go away. So long as the president, any president, fights for his or her place in history and seeks to expand their base of power, even arguing the belief of a unitary executive, signing statements are going to be used. But the abuse of this program has not gone unnoticed. Several things happened within the last year to bring this issue to light. The first was an article in the Boston Globe that highlighted the president's abuse of the signing statements. The author of that article brought to light, at that time, the 750-plus times the president issued a signing statement. It led to hearings by Senator Leahy. However, despite this evidence, one person, Charles Ogletree, commented on the president's 207 signing statements. An attorney for the Justice Department, Michelle Boardman, stated that the president had only issued 110 signing statements. This was after evidence had been proven to show that as of June 2006, President Bush had issued over 750. But despite the failure to recognize his abuse, the ABA, or American Bar Association, would not sit back. They issued a report and offered recommendations for lawmakers to review, because, Lord knows, this president will not listen to any recommendations. And here were those ABA Task Force recommendations. 1. Signing statements must respect the rule of law and our constitutional system of separation of powers. And here's the reasoning. As noted above, the first recommendation urges that the president and those who succeed him cease the practice of using presidential signing statements to state his intention to disregard or decline to enforce a law or to interpret it in a manner inconsistent with the will of Congress. One of the most fundamental innovations of the American Constitution was to separate the executive from the legislative power. It may well seem burdensome or frustrating to a president to be so confined in his response to the legislative enactments of a Congress. The Supreme Court has acknowledged that the choices made in the Constitutional Convention impose burdens on governmental processes that often seem clumsy, inefficient, even unworkable. But the Court has reminded us that those hard choices were consciously made by men who had lived under a form of government that permitted arbitrary governmental acts to go unchecked, and often restated that there is no better way to preserve freedom than by making the exercise of power subject to the carefully crafted restraints spelled out in the Constitution. The second recommendation was that presidential concerns regarding constitutionality of pending bills should be communicated to Congress prior to passage. And here was their reasoning. The White House and each of the 15 major executive departments maintain large and sophisticated legislative or congressional affairs offices, and routinely and closely track the progress of bills introduced in the Congress. Moreover, much legislation considered by the Congress each session emanates initially from the executive branch. For that reason, it is unlikely that important legislation would be considered and passed without the opportunity for full and fair input by the administration. Therefore, our second recommendation urges the president, if he believes that any provision of a bill pending before Congress would be unconstitutional if enacted, to communicate such concerns to Congress prior to passage. It is reasonable to expect the President to work cooperatively with Congress to identify and ameliorate any constitutional infirmities during the legislative process, rather than waiting until after the passage of legislation to express such concerns in a signing statement. Recommendation number 3. signing statements should not be a substitute for a presidential veto. The third recommendation urges the president to confine signing statements to the meaning, purpose, or significance of bills he has signed into law, which he then must faithfully execute. For example, it is entirely appropriate for the president to praise a bill as a landmark in civil rights or environmental law and applaud its legislative sponsors, or to provide his views as to how the enactment of the law will affect the welfare of the nation. When President Carter signed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, he wrote in his signing statement, "In short, the act helps to solidify the relationship of trust between the American people and their government. It provides a basis for the trust of the American people in the fact that the activities of their intelligence agencies are both effective and lawful." Such statements contribute to public dialogue and accountability. However, the recommendation urges the president not to use signing statements in lieu of compliance with his constitutional obligation to veto any bill he believes violates the Constitution in whole or in part. The obligation follows from the original intent and practice of the Founding Fathers, including President George Washington. To sign a bill and refuse to enforce some of its provisions because of constitutional qualms is tantamount to exercising the line-item veto power held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in Clinton v. New York. The task force opposes the use of presidential signing statements to effect a line-item veto or to usurp judicial authority as the final arbiter of the constitutionality of congressional acts. Definitive constitutional interpretations are entrusted to an independent and impartial Supreme Court, not a partisan and interested president. That is the meaning of Marbury v. Madison. A president could easily contrive a constitutional excuse to decline enforcement of any law he deplored, and transform his qualified veto into a monarch-like absolute veto. The president's constitutional duty is to enforce laws he has signed into being, unless and until they are held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court or a subordinate tribunal. The Constitution is not what the president says it is. Recommendation number 4. Legislation is needed to ensure that the Congress and the public are fully informed about the use of presidential signing statements. Today, when the president issues a signing statement, it is published in the weekly compilation of presidential documents. In addition, since the Reagan administration, signing statements have been included with the legislative history reprinted in the volumes of the U.S. Code Congressional and Administrative News. However, there is no requirement that the statements be submitted to Congress or made readily available to the public. The recommendation seeks to remedy this situation by urging Congress to enact legislation requiring the President promptly to submit to Congress an official copy of all signing statements he issues, and in any instance in which he claims the authority or states the intention to disregard or decline to enforce all or part of a law he has signed, or to interpret such a law in a manner inconsistent with the clear intent of Congress, to submit to Congress a report setting forth in full the reason and the legal basis for the statements. The final recommendation. Legislation is needed to provide for judicial review of presidential signing statements in appropriate cases. The final recommendation addresses the question of how Congress should respond if a president insists on signing statements to declare his intent to refuse to enforce provisions of a bill he has signed into law because of his belief that they are unconstitutional. At present, the standing element of the case or controversy requirement of Article 3 of the Constitution frequently frustrates any attempt to obtain judicial review of such presidential claims of line-item veto authority that trespass on the lawmaking powers of Congress. A signing statement might well elude the case or controversy requirement because the immediate injury is to the lawmaking powers of Congress. The President thus becomes the final judge of his own constitutional powers, and he invariably rules in favor of himself. Therefore, this recommendation urges Congress to enact legislation that would enable the President, Congress, or other entities to seek judicial review, and contemplates that such legislation would confer on Congress as an institution or its agents standing in any instance in which the President uses a signing statement to claim the authority or state the intention to disregard or decline to enforce all or part of a law, or interpret such a law in a manner inconsistent with the clear intent of Congress. If such review were initiated by the Congress or other entities, it could be argued that the concrete injury was the usurpation of the lawmaking powers of Congress by virtue of the provisions of the signing statement, and the denial of the opportunity to override a veto if the President believes a law is unconstitutional, as noted above. Our recommendation also contemplates that the President could initiate such judicial review. The remedy fashioned could be an order directing that the enacted law be fully enforced, since the President would have foregone the opportunity for a veto by signing of the bill, or it could be a more declaratory judgment that the President may not use signing statements in such a manner, but must either enforce a bill which he signs into law or exercise his veto on any bill he believes is unconstitutional. It is hoped that the President would obey any constitutional declaration of the Supreme Court. This recommendation also urges that the Congress and the President support judicial resolution of the President's claim or interpretation through the use of signing statements, for example, by avoiding non-constitutional arguments like the political question doctrine or prudential standing. It would be expected that one case before the Supreme Court would put to rest the constitutionality of a signing statement that announces the President's intent not to enforce the provision of a law or to do so in a manner contradictory to clear congressional intent. In thinking about these recommendations, I am reminded and felt best to also explain to you that when the President holds his ceremonial signings, that an hour after he signs the bill, the President then issues a one-paragraph to several-page signing statement. So the law that he enacts, even though he has signed it, he then adds on his extra statements after the big ceremony, and after the cameras and the microphones have gone away, he then issues his statement silently so that no one is listening. Well, as I mentioned a few podcasts ago, we will be listening. I have put up a link to a website that offers an RSS feed. For every time the President issues a signing statement, you'll be able to read those signing statements, and I encourage you to read them. But in thinking about all of this, in the end, I had to ask myself, what does this all mean? And I've thought about this over and over. This topic was not only meant to inform you, but to add to our national discussion. Discussions that we should all have with each other about the role of the President and the intent to expand presidential power. How a president views his or her role determines everything. Consider again, President Clinton's updates from different staffers about presidential power in comparison to President Bush only being apprised from Vice President Cheney's office only. The unitary executive is not in keeping with the checks and balances of this nation and our Constitution. The framers did not imagine such a role. As a conservative, consider the Constitution. If you're listening, consider its roles and its construction. Read it. Read the language found in the Federalist Papers. And trust me, no president should be above the law. Conservatives would not accept it from a Democratic president, and neither should we from this president. Now, for a musical break for this podcast, I wanted to introduce you to a song by Megaphone. Megaphone, the unofficial band of Indirect Democracy, as always, have been kind enough to allow me to use their music, Not Your Enemy, as the intro and outro for this podcast. But I wanted to introduce you to one of their other songs, the first song off their album, For Crying Out Loud. That song is called Freak, and here it is.
My personality style. on, seriously. Come from the planet in the side of my cheek. I think for myself, I am a freak. I am a freak.
Okay, recently I was contacted by a listener who I'm going to call Irish Catholic Democrat. Mr. Irish Catholic Democrat asked me if I would be interested in reading his diary from the Daily Coast that he posts on occasion. I said I would be glad to. I know Mr. Irish Catholic Democrat, and that's how I'm going to refer to him. I would use his name, but I know that he prefers this. And I will tell you this, just from knowing this guy is uber smart. I kid you not, this guy can absorb languages in a manner that makes you just jealous from the get-go. But he is a bright guy, he's a good guy, I like him very much, and I would like to read to you one of his more newer postings on Daily Coast. And this will be a somewhat recurring thing for the podcast, and of course if you have anything that you would like to have me read on Indirect Democracy, I'd be glad to. But here is this posting from Irish Catholic Democrat. It's called Us versus Giuliani, We Must Go on the Offensive. We should all give pause and think hard the next time we hear someone say something like this. Rudy could win in 2008, but I don't think he'll make it past the primary, especially with his social views. Just as Giuliani's hero status is nothing but conventional wisdom, what I call the imminent primary defeat theory is little more than the same. Don't get me wrong. I also think Rudy's platform presents the biggest potential source of his own electoral demise in the primary. And in light of the treasure trove of mistakes, skeletons, and downright cruel soundbites he has left, part of me even wishes Democrats will have the chance to go negative on him in the general election. However, we can make Rudy the Republican, with the most independent appeal of all, sink in the polls faster than you can say Joe Lieberman by doing our part. We can neutralize his electoral chances. We can stop another Iraq war supporter from taking office if we do one thing early and often. Tell our friends, family, and acquaintances the truth. It's at this point at which I fear I'm stretching the original thought part of the Daily Coast diary posting rules, because we all know at least something that hints at Giuliani's truly creepy Nixonian character. But we get our news here, we publish diaries here, we post commentary here. In a lot of ways, we are preaching to the choir. I'm not accusing anyone here of not being aggressive enough and not getting out the word about Giuliani, mind you. I'm exhorting all of you to go beyond common assumptions about his honor's chances and bring attention to the 99.9% of Giuliani's character and record that other people know nothing about. For starters, I hope to see this link, and I will link this story up for you. Just give me a little bit of time with getting the website up, but back to this posting. I hope to see this link pushed to the top of a Google search and a Google bombing campaign like the one done against Senator McCain. People have to see this. It's a window into the personality of the Giuliani that so many Americans do not know. For independents and swing Democrats, his moderate views on civil unions and abortions may soften his image enough to make him seem like a decent guy. His callous treatment of a Parkinson's patient is anything but decent. It is a reflection on his careless, twisted sense of fiscal conservatism. It's a spending ethic that shortchanges provisions for the less fortunate among us while paying mere lip service to the desire of middle-class Americans for greater security and prosperity. Especially in light of the recent news about a 12-year-old Prince George's County boy that died from a perfectly treatable toothache, so-called fiscal conservatives who have supported Bush's tax cuts and funding cuts in Medicaid need to be exposed for their heartlessness. This draconian, downright un-American brand of fiscal ethics must be knocked off its perch in the White House. Giuliani's candidacy begs another question. Can this man actually deliver us sound national security? No, of course not. Any man who preaches about the GOP being a party of the future while supporting George W. Bush's leadership record and our failed policy in Iraq is utterly incapable with national security. If he doesn't believe in bringing the fight to those who really attacked us on 9/11, any credibility he won on that day is void. Coupled with his inability to oppose the Bush war strategy, his startling Bush-like intolerance for criticism is too dangerous for the White House. Talk continues about Giuliani's position in the pro-life, pro-choice debate. Let's make it crystal clear to our fellow Americans right now. Rudy is not pro-life. This is not an indictment of his pro-choice position. It's an indictment of his heartless record on welfare, his disregard for the black community in the wake of the murder of Amadou Diallo, and his rabid continued support for the war in Iraq. It's an indictment of anything that is not a clean, principled break with the policies and ethics of the Bush White House. Reorienting our national security and promoting a better standard of living for the American people cannot be carried out by any Republican, no matter how moderate he may be on a slim number of issues. In closing, let me make myself clear. The next time you or any fellow Democrat wants to expound on your hatred for Hillary, stop. The New York politician that should bear the burden of our criticism and suspicion is Giuliani. He is not a rhino, or Republican in name only. He is just the crusading authoritarian that the GOP would want as a successor to Bush. And stop calling him Rudy. It gives a kind human face to a man who has no patience for criticism, no compassion for the poor or middle class, and none of the principles necessary for the war on terrorism. Let's start thinking of ways to get out the truth on his honor's record. I'll include a poll with some of my ideas, and I will be participating in the comments section. Thanks a lot to those of you who read through all of this. P.S. I published an earlier diary on Giuliani, which has tons of links about his honor that would be great for passing around. Go for it. Why say no when saying yes feels so good? And that was the diary posting for Irish Catholic Democrats. Well, now it's the time of the podcast when I have to pay the bills, so here is this week's newest sponsor.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is your captain speaking, and if you take a look out your window, oh, why, hello there. Up here in the cockpit, the view is spectacular. Back in the cabin, what I wouldn't give for some of the comforts that you're experiencing. Finely crafted seats with lumbar support, plenty of leg room, state-of-the-art television screens in the back of the seats, a stellar sound system created by Bose Electronics. Yep, nothing more comforting than that. Until you try the food. I mean, we only serve the top-of-the-line food here. Heck, even our kids' meals are created by the chefs who hold nutrition and taste as their top priority. Yep, good food, good drinks, and entertainment in our cabinet are only part of what makes this trip great. And all this at rates that make our competition wonder how we get our customers. The secret is, once we get you, you're not leaving. Here at Needy Airlines, we are desperate for your love and affection. And if you thought JetBlue kept you on the tarmac too long, yeah, wait till you see what we do. I have passengers to attend to, this is your captain speaking. If you look out your left window, you'll see the terminal. I'll bet you want to go there. You've been wanting to leave all along. Yeah, don't think I didn't notice you staring at the other airplanes. Fine. See if I care.
No, wait. I was just kidding. Don't go. Look, we have champagne for you all. Champagne. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Champagne. And you'll get drunk and try to get affectionate. I know this game. You'll say how handsome I am and then try to trick me into leaving. Well, I'm not falling for that again. You only love me when you get drunk. Look at all I do for you.
Needy Airlines. Going somewhere? No, you're not.
Why won't you love me?
Well, now it's the time of the podcast to give out the real What a Weenie Award. And this one is in joint conjunction with the global warming update. And it's important, and it had to be addressed. This What a Weenie Award goes to Drew Johnson and the Tennessee Center for Policy Research. This week, Mr. Johnson and his group issued a report criticizing Vice President Al Gore and his stance on the environment, stating that despite Mr. Gore's statements about reducing power consumption to reduce your carbon footprint, Mr. Johnson and his group claim that Mr. Gore's consumption is higher than the average citizen, and he is in essence a hypocrite. Here is a sample of what Mr. Johnson had to say on the Ed Schultz Show.
This is a man who tells you and I what light bulbs to have in our bathrooms, but he's also a man who himself uses 20 times more electricity than the average person in America. The average person, you and I, use about 10,000 kilowatt hours per year. He uses 221,000 kilowatt hours a year.
You report that his average monthly electric bill was said to be more than $1,300 last year.
Correct. In total, his natural gas bill and his electrical bills were $30,000 last year. The fact of the matter is he's telling us to turn our thermostats down to 60 degrees and wear a sweater, while he must have his on 75 and a t-shirt all winter. I'm not exactly sure.
Now, his spokeswoman said, quote, "The Gores purchase all of their power through the local green power switch program. It is 100% renewable power." What's wrong with that?
God bless him for doing that. But as I said, there's no specific line that runs to his house to do this green power. He's still using regular coal-burning electricity provided by the TVA.
And how do you know there's no, Drew, how do you know there's no line to his house?
I know for a fact, as a resident of Nashville who uses the same exact power lines as Mr. Gore, that they certainly don't have that available to their customers.
Now, I immediately started doing the research to check and refute Mr. Johnson's claims. In doing so, I discovered this clip by Keith Olbermann. So, because of my deep admiration and respect, and because he pretty much said everything I wanted to say, I will let Mr. Olbermann's commentary address the first part of my argument against Mr. Johnson.
He may never run for office again, and the man chosen president over him has now come around to his way of thinking about global warming. But face it, to the far right, Al Gore is still an inconvenient truth teller. Hard on the heels of his documentary's Oscar came the headlines. A nonpartisan think tank had revealed that Mr. Gore's own personal energy bill is 20 times the national average. So is our third story tonight outrageous hypocrisy, a minor embarrassment, or a demonstration of a different kind of wind power? First, that allegedly nonpartisan think tank, which just happens to have gotten its story picked up by the notorious Drudge Report today, is called the Tennessee Center for Policy Research. 27-year-old President Jason Drew Johnson, hailing from the same American Enterprise Institute that takes money from big oil, cheerleads the war in Iraq, and consistently, and now to pretty consistent laughter, downplays global warming. That said, even a partisan think tank can get the facts straight. So the facts. Last year, Gore's Tennessee property consumed almost 221,000 kilowatt hours, 20 times the national average. It cost him more than $16,300. But Johnson's press release calling on Gore to walk the walk when it comes to home energy use omits several other key facts. The former vice president's home has 20 rooms, including home offices for himself and his wife, as well as a guest house and special security measures. Furthermore, the Gores buy energy produced from renewable sources such as wind and solar. Tonight, Countdown confirmed with the local utility officials that their program, called the Green Power Switch, actually costs more for the Gores, $4 for every 150 kilowatt hours, meaning by our calculations, our math here, that the Gores actually chose to increase their electric bill by $5,893, more than 50%, in order to minimize carbon pollution. The utility is also telling us that some smaller homes consume energy in the same range of usage as does the one on the Gore's property.
Back to the clips that you heard earlier from Mr. Johnson. There was a part of what Mr. Johnson said that almost made me laugh, and not in a good way. It was when he criticized Mr. Gore's statements telling him how to live.
I don't have any problem with that. Actually, I respect the former vice president a great deal, and I have no problem with him leading the charge for the environmental movement. What I do have a problem with is a man who tells all Americans and basically tells everybody in the world what to do behind the closed doors of their houses.
You know, it could only be the gall of a conservative that would say, "Don't tell me how to live." This from the party that mandates the invasion of personal privacy, from illegal wiretaps to reproductive rights, religious beliefs, and who consenting adults can and cannot marry. The audacity of that statement alone is enough to give him the What a Weenie Award. But that is not enough. On a week where the focus should be on educating people on a real threat to our planet, this idiot makes news by falsely claiming that Mr. Gore is a hypocrite. Mr. Johnson's real concern lays with the fear-based partisanship of his beliefs, and if he would just listen to what Vice President Gore and many others are trying to say, then he would realize that no one is trying to harm him, this country, or this planet. I have to ask the big question. On the issue of global warming, what are the conservatives so afraid of? Let's get this out in the open. Yes, the planet has gone through many varied weather patterns and cycles. Yes, that part is true. Ice ages have come and gone, and the planet is still here. And luckily, so are we. But this change, what is occurring now, is our fault. We are doing this. To a 90-degree plus range of certainty, the leading scientists on the planet all agree that the current pattern of global climate change is man-made. 90% certainty. Do you know how many issues are 90% certain on this magnitude? Not many. And this one matters. But what is the right so damn afraid of? On the off chance that the 10% is correct and the progressive community and the scientific community is wrong, please, if you are conservative and listening to this, tell me what are the worst things that could occur. You recycle more, causing less of a depletion of our natural resources. You buy energy-saving appliances and light bulbs that in the end save you money on your electric bill. You take mass transit, which saves you money in gas and wear and tear on your car, and if you're lucky, your job might pay you for doing that. We invest in alternative fuels, which means a lesser dependency on foreign oil. It inspires new technologies, which means new jobs and new industries. It also means that certain pockets of the United States become the world leader in fuel output due to ethanol or biodiesel, and the Saudis need us instead of us needing them. You plant a tree, making your neighborhood or your little slice of the world just a touch more beautiful. All that could happen, making the world just a little better for us all, even if all the leading scientists are wrong about man's role in global warming. Or you could just keep doing what we are doing, making a depleting natural resource in crude oil the only thing that matters. No new jobs, no new technologies, and living at the whim of the political ebbs and flows of other nations. Even if everything is wrong about global warming, why persist on following a strategy that does not allow this country to pursue its own destiny and maybe make the world a better place? If you're a conservative and your only real basis for this argument is the fear that you are wrong on this issue, do us all a favor. Take a deep breath and let it go. Don't be like Mr. Johnson, so wrapped up in his fear and the need to be correct on this issue that he won't even begin to think to address all that can be gained if we follow a road of less energy consumption and investment in renewable energy. It is the road we need to follow. Don't be a weenie like Mr. Johnson. And on a lighter note, it just occurs to me that Johnson is another word for a weenie. Oh, man, has this podcast gone down the wrong road? But I do thank you for taking the time to listen to podcast number 24 of Indirect Democracy. I would like to thank Irish Catholic Democrat for his contribution. Once again, if you'd like to reach me, you can do so by contacting me at david@indirectdemocracy.com. You can also call me at area code 206-339-4797. As always, I would like to thank Matt Bloodwell and the guys at Megaphone for allowing me to use their music, Not Your Enemy, from the album For Crying Out Loud. You can find that song and the song Freak via their websites, which are www.megaphonemusic.net and their MySpace account at myspace.com/megaphone. You can also purchase, and I do encourage you to purchase, their music through iTunes. As well, I'd like to encourage you, if you liked what you heard, turn a friend on to Indirect Democracy, and if you are listening to other members of the Progressive Podcast Network, turn them on to what's going on over there. But I do want to thank you for taking the time to listen. Be sure to take care of yourselves, take care of each other. I will see you next week. Bye for now. Happy birthday, Rachel!